Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Psychology of Work, Why People Do What They Do, a podcast exploring the science and stories behind high-cohesion, high-performing teams. My name is Dr. Bobbi Wegner. I'm a lecturer at Harvard in organizational psychology and the founder of Groups. In each episode, we dive into the minds of industry experts to uncover what drives team and individual dynamics, tackle real-world challenges together, and share actionable insights to help teams feel and function their best. Thanks so much for joining, and let's get started. Everyone, welcome back to The Psychology of Work. I'm super, super excited to be here today. So I'm here with Jason Desense, a global HR executive who spent more than two decades advising CEOs and boards on how organizations grow and change. He's currently the Chief Human Resources Officer for Toshiba's Americas Operations, where he's leading change on bringing AI into the heart of HR from recruitment all the way to talent intelligence. He's worked across automotive, manufacturing, healthcare, finance, so many different things. And he's really a sought-after keynote speaker on the future of work and where leadership goes next. Jason, I'm just super psyched to have you here. I would love to hear from your own mouth, like, who are you? What's your story?
Well, that's always a fun question. Thank you, first off, for having me. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be on your show. Really, really excited to be here. Yeah, I've actually been, you know, if I were to say that I actually planned my entire path, I'd be lying, obviously. I fell into HR. It was kind of one of those things where I was going to be actually a police officer. I went to school undergrad. On my mom's side, family of police officers. So I used to watch Perry Mason and you know, and watch the detective shows and Hill Street Blues with my family. But anyways, that didn't really turn out to be. And then I actually needed a role after college and being in the automotive industry here in Detroit, where I'm from. I had the privilege to join Ford Motor Company, where I started off as a trainer and just worked my way up through the ranks in HR and found that actually I was pretty good at it and had a lot of different great mentors along the way that saw the talent more so than I saw in myself and, you know, kind of worked me in different roles. And I pretty much sat in almost every HR chair and have had the privilege of really being a CHRO for over 10 years now in various different forms. And I've seen quite a bit in different industries. And my background, I think, is unique in the way that I'm not just one industry proficient. I'm also a learner by trade, which I love to learn. I've taken, obviously, a gazillion assessments and everything always pops that I'm a learner, which makes a lot of sense, which then I also like to teach as well, which is where my keynote comes in. But I really have had the privilege of really seeing many different transformations along the workforce curve over the last 25 plus years. I can't believe it's been this long already. But now I'm actually have take all that knowledge and apply it to today's workforce, which is still ever changing, right? We're back to many different generations in the workforce. And now AI has just exploded. It's everywhere. So it's the hot topic. But the calculated approach I take is really taking all the amalgamation of all the industries I've been a part of, all the key learnings I've had, great mentors even till to this day, as well as I reference a lot my own children who are Gen Zers, 23 and 21. And, you know, I run a lot of things by them, just kind of getting a sense of where they're at. So I'm always constantly gauging the best thing in the workforce. But that is my background, a kid from Detroit. And I have the privilege now of leading the CHRO function for Toshiba Americas. I live in Houston as well. That's where our Toshiba headquarters in the U.S. So I have the privilege of being down there as well as still being in Detroit.
I mean, super cool. So many things are jumping to mind for me. One, the first thing, and we'll take a deeper dive in a minute, is like, you're naming all these things that are putting pressure on society and the workforce, right? All these, this changing thing. So I feel like that learner perspective is really helpful, right? It's like taking from all different industries and we can like take a deeper dive that on a minute. But what I'm curious about is like, so police officer to HR, right? What are the parallels? What are the differences? Like, you know, what do you see there? It's just...
Yeah, that's a great question. I've never been asked that. So funny enough, you're the first. But, you know, I will tell you my interrogation techniques help when I have to do investigations in HR. There's certain techniques, certain ways you ask a question, certain ways you approach people. So that is definitely...
Totally.
But it's not so much the policing aspect. It's the way and look in which I think of it like a puzzle.
Yeah.
And if you're, I always wanted to be a detective. So I say police officer, but really I wanted to be like the detective, you know, figuring out, you know, here's a situation, a crime or whatever it may be. Now you've got to figure out how to solve that, right? So it's kind of gets into problem solving. So if I were to say the connection, it really goes into more of a Lean Six Sigma approach. I'm looking at a challenge. I don't always like to call it a problem, but a challenge. And how can I maneuver around it like a puzzle piece and figure out, first of all, can I deduce what caused it and understand it so it doesn't happen again? And then what can I do or measure to put in place to mitigate that risk that occurred? So that way I go forward and not only do I improve, but I also maybe even enhance. So that's kind of how I see parallels is the way in which you look at a challenge and the way in which you try to solve that challenge.
It makes perfect sense. You know, when you first said it, I was like, wow, those in my mind seem like two different worlds and industries, but you're making me think. So, you know, we've been wanting to get you to class too, to talk about one of the classes I teach and is all the classes I teach, we teach coaching. So at the way I see the world is building cohesion, build relationships. Coaching is a great vehicle for managers and leaders to ask questions, to get to the heart of the problem, to be able to solve it. So it feels like that's the parallel you're seeing. So in my motivation class, you know, we're teaching motivational interviewing skills, which is really a coaching kind of technique. But I pull from different industries to have people see, like, you can use this type of approach in different ways. And one guy we listen to is Chris Voss, which is a hostage negotiator. He wrote the book Never Split the Difference, you know, all that. But the students, we start to highlight, like, the way he asks questions to negotiate a hostage release is the same way coaches and therapists and psychologists, you're looking for shared goals and wins for everybody. And like, you're trying to get to the bottom of a problem to be able to solve it. And there's a way you do that by like peeling back the layers. So I feel like that's what came to mind when you were.
Yeah. And in fact, that's exactly. So when I was in organizational development, organizational effectiveness role, I had the greatest job I've ever had. You really don't do anything, because what you do is you just ask a group of questions to get people to figure it out for themselves. Yeah. And I always focus on John Cotter's 8-step to change. Step one is creating the sense of urgency. I understand that change needs to happen, but if you need to get the other person to understand it so they recognize, oh, wow, you're right, there is an urgent need. And the way I do that is through the form of question orientation. It's not just telling them, you know, and that's how you get buy-in, right? The last step of the 8 steps of change is buy-in. Well, there's obviously more steps in between, but the first step is knowing that there needs to be a change. And then once you get through, and there's things like short-term wins and stuff like that, that get you there. But again, and that's where the buy-in really happens. And the aha, or the, you know, little light bulb goes off in people's heads. And they're like, oh, that makes sense now. And then, okay, now let's go.
So interesting. And you know what's even weirder? Totally serendipitous. I just met with him yesterday. You said John Cotter.
John Cotter, really?
Eight
Steps to Change.
One of his executives. So he's a Harvard guy. Our company is being incubated in Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. So I don't even know if you know this part, and I've got to get your eyeballs on this actually now that I'm thinking, but we're building out a whole platform that functions like an agentic team psychologist, right? So the entrepreneur in residence advisor there is good friends with an executive at Cotter. So we just spent like an hour and a half or 2 hours yesterday going through their model and you know, the intersection with groups and the way the world's changing and all this stuff. Just so weird you brought that up, you know, because I met with them late yesterday afternoon. It was my last call actually I had since this one. So weird.
Yeah, I actually just referenced them the other day at a keynote. So I use that, you know, I don't go through all the steps, but it really, it resonates with people to understand. It's like, again, I understand change needs to happen, but as a HR person and a coach, you have to influence others to recognize it. That's your first step.
Nobody will make a change. And like, you know, you can't force someone. You can't like, so you have to get them. And that's where the motivation, this class, which will be great for you to come to, is like, helping unpack what motivates, like, underneath all behavior, right? Behaviors, whatever you want someone to do, there's the thoughts and the feelings that are going to drive that behavior. So you got to understand someone's thoughts and you got to understand their feelings. And then you got to figure out like what's in it for them to do the behavior. Otherwise, they're not going to do this. They don't care. It doesn't matter. They're going to like drive yourself nuts just trying to force a hand.
my wife, speaking of change, my wife always, she had this one t-shirt she referenced. She said, you got to get this t-shirt. It says, I love change, you go first.
Totally. And that's actually, I feel like I've been having a lot of conversations recently about AI adoption. And what I think people are missing is that AI adoption is a behavior change. You want someone to do something new, right? And then companies are like feeling this pressure to go do this thing, but they're not thinking about it as like what people are feeling or what they're thinking about it. Do they have the skills to do it? And do they have a need? But I know, you're really focused on integrating AI into the HR function across a board, across a company. Like, what do you think here? What's your take?
Yeah, actually, the way I think about it, so the company thinks of FOMO because their fear of missing out on AI because we got to go do it. The employee is FOBO, fear of being obsolete. So there's this dichotomy of people going, well, the company's like, well, we got to go do it. And we don't really know why, but everybody else is doing it. We better do it before something passes us. And then you got the employee going, oh, I don't really want to do it because maybe if I do too good of a job, then my job's gone. Totally. Right. So it's this obsolete sense. However, what I've been teaching is let's start with the low hanging fruit. So we are a Microsoft 365 shop. So we're Copilot.
Yeah.
And the great thing about Toshiba is that they're born out of the innovative necessity. That's the original intent. Over 150 years ago, our founders were inventors.
Yeah.
And they loved innovation. So the Toshiba at one point was the fourth largest patent holder in the world. So we were constantly, so we're known for innovation. And why is that important? Because it fosters a culture where we can actually have the autonomous time to what I say, play.
Mm-hmm.
And my team has started to play with AI as far as agents. And we actually did like a Shark Tank. I did kind of a little competition. The winner got these points, which they can go get gift cards or whatever for. But we've created about six agents. One, we have Payroll Princess that handles mm-hmm. all your payroll needs mm-hmm. and answers your questions. We have Time Tamer that helps you with attendance, doing schedules for managers, but also attendance questions. And then we have something around our recruitment side where it helps build actual, recruitment needs for the managers and build the interview guides, et cetera, around the particular role that's more specific to the need. So we're starting to have this play. And as well as I'm working with a potential outside vendor to bring in AI coaching. And even then, we're still doing what I call A/B testing or proof of concept, where with AI coaching, what we want to do is potentially give one sales team an AI coach and then not the other. And then we're going to do a little test to see, does it actually improve, closing of deals, giving additional, forms of how I can communicate better with my clients, external clients for sales, et cetera, et cetera. So because originally coaching was seen as an elite thing for an executive or a manager, right? Usually when you got coaching.
Yeah.
But now we're at a point where we can give everybody who's a computer-based learner an actual AI coach, where if I had something so earlier on, I wonder how much better I'd be as a leader growing up and
totally.
Not fall into the trappings of what managers do time and time again, which is why they need coaching, if you think about it.
You're preaching to the choir here. So like in groups world, like the thing we measure and care about and what we've studied and everything that the classes I teach, like focus on are cohesion. We know cohesion, sort of the connection plus alignment on teams is a thing that drives outcomes. But then it falls to managers to like build cohesion on teams, and managers don't know how to do this. They're just not trained, and not by any fault of their own, but everyone's pointing fingers at the middle manager, like go solve all these problems. And we get back to that point you're talking about. There's so much pressure, right? And all these things, and multi-generational stuff, AI, global crises, mm-hmm. Distribution. And then we're like, why are teams falling apart? The manager's got to figure this out. But like managers are like, I don't have training and I don't need just like another skills-based thing. I need to understand how to actually coach to build cohesion the same way an MBA team psychologist or coach learns to coach a team to bring them together. You don't need, mm-hmm. but at what level, like how do you democratize that basically,
Yeah. You know, it's always interesting, intriguing to me when I was growing up through the ranks of HR, when I became a generalist, business partner model wasn't really in existence then. So you kind of just did everything from recruitment, talent management, coaching. You were a coach, but no one taught me how to coach, right? It was just, well, you're in charge, Jason. Let me come to you with this problem. And you're like, oh, all right. Well, and you just kind of talk through it and you use kind of all the learnings I've had, or I will go talk to one of my mentors like, hey, I got this guy. This is what he's experiencing. Can you help me kind of walk through what's a good technique? But what I always found is even before I became a manager, I already knew how to be a manager because I was coaching managers.
Totally.
But that's kind of scary model, right? If you think about it, it's like you've got people who don't really have professional training actually teaching managers until they get a professional coach or a mentor, then they get real training. So I think we've had it backwards for a really long time. But I also think those leaders like myself, when I did become a manager, I knew some of the trappings already so I could avoid them, but I still had different trappings as I grew up. And I was lucky to always have people alongside of me that I can reference. So even though now I'm an executive coach. Now I coach CEOs, everybody, you know, but I still go get coached myself because I still need it because I'm still learning. In fact, it's going to sound weird, but I say coaching down, meaning I look at the younger generation for more information from them.
Yeah.
And I'm soliciting a lot more from them, trying to understand where they're at and what their values are, because they're completely different than us Gen Xers, where, you know, we were latchkey kids growing up, you know, two parents working and just had to figure it out. But now they have so much more information. YouTube can tell them everything. Hopefully it's right. But that's kind of where they're learning from.
Yeah, there's so much there. That then, like, the coaching mentality, I'm thinking, like, through, you know, I think a lot in, like, leadership development world, there's often like, here's a framework, go do this thing, and here's the skills. And it's like, that only goes so far. But when you're training as a coach or you're training as a psychologist, it's really, you know, from a psych lens, where it's like the first thing we're training psychologists, it's self, other, space, in between. What are you bringing? What's the other person bringing? And what's the intersection? And how is it supporting the shared goals? So get back to, like, motivation, right? Like, in a therapeutic context, it's like, I want this person to stop smoking. They want to stop smoking. What am I bringing to the dynamic to help them? What are they bringing, their own wants, needs? And then how are we intersecting? Is this actually going to work? It's no different in business. The goals are just different, right? The business goals are KPIs and revenue and profitability and all those things. But are we in alignment around how we get there? Yeah. How am I going to help you get there? How are you going to get there? What do you bring to the table? But when you drill down there, when you're training as a coach, it's less about skills. It's like, who are you? What are your value sets?
Right.
You know, what are your habits of thinking, feeling, and doing? Do you have the actual knowledge to ask questions, to your point, to get to the bottom of things rather than advice giving? Can you, like, manage your own feelings when you're, like, you know, ring someone across from you?
So there's two sides to that. So the way I approach it too is I use science. There's a left and the right side of the brain, right? Everyone thinks the logical side is where business really happens.
Yeah.
Like, yes, we've got the data, we've got the analytics, we've got it's logical. It's, you know, everything's on this side. But 9 times out of 10, most major business decisions are based on how I feel, the trust side, the creative side. So I focus on, when I'm influencing people, I focus literally on the trust side. Because once I gain their trust, and, you know, and I work for a Japanese organization, which in of itself has a cultural aspect that from Americans are completely different of the value systems and structure and checks and balances, if you will, too. So I have to meet them both sides. But what I do know is on the right side of the brain, where that trust and influences and values, that's where I win.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, once they trust me and want, and I just want to jog Connor's thing, the short-term wins, small wins. If I have a couple of small wins and they're like, all right, Jason seems like he knows what he's doing. You know, I'm going to trust you next time when there's a big thing happening. I'm not going to ask you for all this data and all this stuff because I now trust you. So we don't focus or say those kind of things in the business world. When you listen to an earnings call, it's always on the left side of the brain.
100%.
They never say it. They never, we're EBITDA, we're really good. Cash flow is great. Op Inc. wasn't that bad. I mean, our, you know, return on sales number percentage is X. You know, you don't really talk about the cultural asset. Now, by the way, if you read a proxy of any company, there's always this talent management or talent portion that they like to talk about. And that's how board structures are structured, right? You have governance committee, audit committee, compensation committee, which isn't just comp nowadays. It deals with talent management and how we're looking at succession planning, retention of our top talent, and how we're developing our talent. We don't spend enough time, even though companies know that's what their competitive advantage is against their competition. It's not necessarily the products and services, because think of the autos. They all make cars, but what differentiates them is, why this cool designer who just created the Viper that's just, you know, when I was at Chrysler, like, wow, that's going to put us on the map. Or come up with something innovative. That's what people are strive for when they really speak outwardly. But sometimes inwardly in the business, they don't act that way. So there's a little dichotomy of how, you know, how they're thinking about it and how they actually, you know, do as I say, not as I do sometimes.
1,000%. And it's like, industry is not mapped to how humans function. It, like, human psychology, industry is still catching up. But that's what I think is really cool about this time. It's putting pressure on companies to change the playbook, because, you know, distribution coming out of COVID, the cross-generationals, there's so AI, everything is disrupting. And I know everyone says disruption, annoying word, whatever, but it's true. It's blowing the lid off of all of this. And instead of kind of playing by the normal playbook, it's like, what actually works and what's going to drive outcomes? there's something you said though. Oh, I'm so curious about this. And I want to jump into the cross-generational thing. Yeah. You were talking about how Toshiba it's a Japanese company, right? Is it Japanese?
Yes. Yeah.
Yep. Japanese company. Like yep. What do you notice from more of a cross-cultural sort of because it's so big, it's been around for a long time. What do you notice in terms of it being a Japanese company that might be similar or different to a company that was sort of born in the States?
Yeah. The one thing I appreciate about both sides, right? American side and Japanese side. The Japanese side is more about harmony and making sure we're working within a cohesive structure, which makes a lot of sense, right?
And, kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Cool. That's
and,
great.
And America. Yeah. And Americans are like cowboys, right? Like we just come shooting away and we'll ask questions later. And that's not all American. I get that. But if you think about where, and I come from the autos, Toyota, which is a Japanese company, they created basically, Lean Six Sigma and all of that structure, which now a lot of Americans follow, right? Because it's a structural, that's that harmony, right? That's that structural way to look at a situation and also giving autonomous opportunity to folks to actually make more decisions on their own. Meaning if you know anything about Lean Six Sigma, at Toyota, the janitor can stop the line if they see a problem because they have that authority. And they've been given that authority because they've been trained in such a way to spot waste, spot sometimes non-efficiency, et cetera. But so that's what was interesting to the American side. We learned a lot from that in the auto industry. And that's why Toyota for a long time was destroying the auto industry because they were just more efficient, coming up with more creative ways. You used to hear all these really cool ways in which they would entice their work staff to come up with ideas to save the company money. No one really does that. Toyota started that. They really encouraged everybody to have a say. Now, that's kind of a very Japanese way of everyone having a voice, but at the same time, they also want it in a structured way, which I appreciate. American side, I think what we've learned over the last is we just work ourselves to death, I think, sometimes. And as an executive, for a long time, I would just thought, well, it was about being at work all the time, literally physically being there I said, I may not be the smartest, but I'm certainly going to outwork you. I'm going to volunteer for everything. I'm going to be here at 6 a.m. I'm going to leave at 7 p.m. That's the way it used to be, right? Mm-hmm. Now, as the generations have evolved, I'm in the sandwich generation. I had the boomers who were constantly,
all right, Jason,
you're leaving at 5 o'clock. What do you have? Baker's hours, and you're like, you're like, no, I literally just put in a 10-hour day, work through my lunch, but now you've got the, it started with millennials starting going, we need work-life balance more, guys.
Yeah.
And then Gen Z is like, yeah, we're out of here. If we don't find value, even in the work we do, forget about the timeline.
Yeah.
And COVID also taught us that we didn't need to be in the office full time. Toshiba's hybrid as well. We value that. We understand that now. We see the value in productivity, but we also find ways to be creative because I also believe innovation happens inside the office where no one's looking, like the water cooler, like walking around with someone just to get a couple little minutes of exercise. I do walking meetings in the plants if I can with my staff just because I want to see what's going on in the factory. One, I want to be visible to the employees. Two, I want to learn what they're doing. I want to hear about their personal family challenges if they haven't, if they're willing to share. But that's the way to connect with people. So there's a lot of positives I've gained from the lower generations that I'm even still learning from on a constant basis. So it's but you have to be open. That's the difference. You have to be open to change. Again, you have to be the one to go first if you love change, not letting 100%. Somebody
else. Yeah, as a leader, there's power in every relationship and every dynamic, sure. And so people just don't talk about it, but it's there. But if you're the one who holds the power, how do you go first to neutralize the power, to invite people in, especially if there's like that big of a gap between, kind of the new employees, the younger generation. And what I was talking about too is like these dynamics are sitting there, right? So that's there and it's going to be affecting how you do work or not. And so if you have a whole bunch of Gen Zers on your team and you're a boomer and you just want them to do what you want them to do, that's not going to work because you're not motivating them. They're going to be disengaged. You're going to have a retention, engagement, profitability problem because you're sub-optimized. So how can you sort of recognize those dynamics, neutralize the power, get curious, and then collaborate, name the shared goals, whatever it is. It could be, profitability, whatever it is. And then be like, how do we get there based on our unique contributions, right? And we know that like the, you know, values we have about work are shaped by the age in which we enter the workforce. So like boomers, agreed, for example, really love predictability and stability. They would be with an organization for 30 years, right? And
I remember that.
Loyalty. Gen Zers, not so much. They came in during COVID. They want like freedom and flexibility and autonomy and purpose. I don't think both are have different things. They're both sitting on the team. How do we bring them together to build cohesion to actually accomplish that shared goal? But leaders aren't having that conversation because they don't really know. No. They're just like forcing the hand. And that's where the coaching stuff comes in too, I think.
Yeah. And I talk about this concept, authentic vulnerability also is being not only being authentic in what you value, but also being vulnerable and saying, and actually having the honest conversation to say, I don't understand why you want to do that. I don't understand why, you know, Gen Z asking the boomer going, well, I don't understand why you need me to be here for 10 hours a day when I can get this done in six, you know, and vice versa going, the boomer going, I don't know why you need individual time for yourself when it's called work for a reason. It's not necessarily a fun place to be, but it's called work.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's this, and I hear both sides, right? And honestly, for me, it's striking a balance, but also I think too often it's not one way or the other. That's the challenge. And people think it's one way or the other. We can do the same thing just in different ways, as long as we're okay and open to that. If someone wants to work 10 hours to do that and we're okay with that, so what? If someone can do it in six, so what as well? We should be okay with that as well. And I think the other challenge that I think the younger generation does struggle with at times, that I teach this to my kids, is it's okay to make a mistake.
Yeah.
We have rewarded all the time so much that we forgot that it's okay to make a mistake, because they don't want to be called out because it's so negative.
Yeah.
And I don't like the term constructive feedback, because to me, there's nothing constructive about it. So it's just feedback or constructive criticism, rather. So it's like, look, you're going to get better, but winning is so much better when you know how to lose.
Yeah.
And what I tell my kids, it's I expect you to make mistakes. It's what you do after that defines you as a person. Do you brush off, get back up because you know resilience? Do you say when you're sorry when you've made a mistake? Yeah. Too often we don't do that anymore. We're just like, we hide and we're like, oh, I hope they don't know. And I hope, you know, so it's okay to make a mistake. And I don't know why, for some reason in society, we have gone away from that. And I actually think we've gone from being curious to cautious.
Oh, 100%.
And And we don't know how to fail. And if you look at anybody in history, and I'll use automotive, Henry Ford, you think Ford Motor Company was his first company?
Yeah.
Nope. he failed twice before he became Ford Motor Company. Colonel Sanders didn't start making beautiful KFC until he was in his 60s, after he was a failed carpet or whatever, door-to-door salesman. You know, he opened up a gas station where he made chicken and it just happened to boom. So I think failure teaches us how to succeed sometimes. And I think we don't talk about failure enough. And we say the terms failure is not an option. Yes, and is kind of my approach. So I think we got to tell people it's okay. Give them the space to fail. And where it's okay. And I always tell anyone who works for me, I will support you when you do great things. I will support you when you don't do such great things. Now, I hope you do more great things, but my point is I'm here for you and I support you. That's what people really want to know. It's a safe space to fail.
Oh yeah. That like culture of fallibility, right? If you promote that, then people will be honest about it and then you can solve it faster.
Yeah.
So it's tied to operational speed, which people don't think of, you know, they're like,
you're asking for help.
Yeah. You're asking for help. And then as a leader, if someone's coming to you with a problem, you can actually help them solve it a lot faster versus sitting in front of a computer hedging and now you're losing time. And, you know, so that idea of like thanking the messenger, like, thanks for being honest. Thanks for giving that sort of, you know, feedback and like helping me like see this a different way or see how I can help you, you know, is very tied to operational speed, which I think people don't think of, you know?
Nope. And then thank yous are free.
Yeah. And then leaders don't know how to like hold that. They're like, I need to give this feedback so it doesn't happen again, where it shuts down the conversation. You know, versus like getting curious and like assuming the person had best intention and that it didn't work out and that's okay. So like, what else could we try next time? It's a semantics thing. That's going to change the way, you know, people come to you or not. Same with parenting, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and I have my special needs child. My younger son had a heart transplant at age 3. So what that also taught me from a workforce perspective is I couldn't be there all the time.
Yeah.
And I was at a time when I was early in my career,
like so much
in my late 20s.
Yeah.
And I was a high potential in the auto industry. And I had to leave some of these special programs because I had to be at the hospital. But I'll tell you what, when I did that, what I realized and I didn't understand is people don't understand their own perceptions in their organization.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, they really don't, you know, and perception becomes reality.
Yeah.
And how, you know, it's like perceived quality versus actual quality, right?
Yeah.
And the reality of what it is I found that I could leave and still be a high potential and be with my son and be with my family. But back then you didn't understand that because I was at a time when I'm working just for the boomers and that wasn't acceptable. Right. But my career went skyrocketed after my son. And I do a lot now. And I share that story only because I want others to understand you could have personal things in your life happen and still be very successful.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much there. And sharing that story, you know, and I identify personally. So I'm youngest of five kids. My older sister had pretty severe developmental disabilities, you know, genetic thing, you know, had a anoxic event at birth. So global, you know, kind of brain injury. And she was my roommate until I was 16. So she's the maid of honor at my wedding. She has since passed.
That's awesome. 14
years ago. But
I'm sorry.
But so grew up in the special needs kind of world and really why I became a psychologist. So I function more like an organizational psychologist now, but I'm a health psychologist by training. And a lot of that is mindset and like controlling what you can and letting the rest go and changing the way you're dealing with your body and thinking all the things. Anyway, I wouldn't have to go down my own personal story here. But I'll
be honest. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it was the first time I recognized that I needed external help to think through these things.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I went to therapy.
Yeah.
First time I went to therapy.
Yeah. It's these personal things that kind of, and we all have them. We just don't share them, especially at work.
Really?
But then also we know when we look at high cohesion, high performing teams, vulnerability is one of these key things that actually builds cohesion, which drives outcomes. So then the question is like, how do you share? How do you have leaders build a culture where you can talk about these things, but also not have it be a therapy session? Right. And then how do you cut people off or contain it and also create disclosure, which is super art, you know? Mm-hmm. We worked with this company once. They were incredible. It's like a large creative agency. And we helped them basically put together this panel of senior leaders, actually not just senior leaders, people all over this organization. I can't remember the title, but it was something about like the role of vulnerability in at work or leadership. And it was basically a facilitated group on stage in front of the entire company. And there was like a senior executive, like a beloved administrative assistant who'd been around for 1,000 years, a younger person and someone else. And we started talking about, it was basically like, I don't know how we teed it up, but it was something around like things people don't know about you. And this executive said how his brother had completed suicide when this executive's at work, he got the call and it kind of sent him in a deep depression, but he had to split his personality between work and home. And it was really an intense time and no one in the organization knew. And the administrative person was like, my kid basically hasn't launched. He's in my basement. And it's like creating pressure, like had created a lot of pressure in my marriage and all this stuff. So anyway, it was like in a way that felt professional, but it was sort of letting the wall down between work and personal. And this young woman who was sort of new, she'd been maybe working for a year or two, like raised her hand and said to the executive who talked about losing his brother and was like, and she was almost tearing. She's like, I just feel so much more connected to you now. And I would be so much more likely to come like share with you because now I know, you know, that you get it in a different way. And it was like the most powerful thing. And it wasn't like inappropriate or too, wild.
That's that authentic vulnerability I talk about. And I only in the last 10 years share my backstory. People look at me and they think I was a silver spoon kid. Well, that's not true. My parents were on government assistance.
Yeah.
In fact, when I told this story on another podcast, we used to go behind restaurants into the dumpsters and I was the smallest and the youngest and I would go in and get food because we couldn't.
Yeah.
So it was kind of one of those, I grew up really poor and I worked myself through college, grad school. And it's a drive that it was hard for me to manage because you don't know how to turn it off when it's on.
Yeah, totally.
And then I've been with my wife for 33 years, you know, we met very early on. So we kind of grew up, there's all that growing up together. We have an older son, you know, and he's 23 and my younger son's 21. you know, he had all these challenges, and we didn't treat him any differently because we knew I can't be there forever. So I know a little bit of a tough love kind of was hard at first to do because, you know, times when like a baby, you could leave him in the crib, they'll cry themselves to sleep, but we couldn't do that for him because he would turn blue and he'd be like, okay. And then you pick him up. You're like, okay, buddy, well, he's a baby. What's baby going to do? Oh, they're going to pick me up after 15 minutes. Well, I'll just keep crying.
Yeah.
You're like, dang it. So then you got to deal with all that. But as a kid myself, I didn't know, I always say about parenting, I'm waiting for my parent handbook to come in the mail.
Oh yeah.
I don't know what the heck I'm doing. But you do your best. And, I share those stories not to brag, not to do anything, but it's to your exact point. It's a form of connection, but it's also to say, I understand some things, even though you don't think I do.
Yeah.
And that's really.
And I think there's also an element of like creating a path, especially for younger people in organizations, be like, you can get to Jason's role and you don't have to have been like handed this or, there's a path. And I think with parenting and leadership, like in the org side of the world, we don't talk about the parallels, but there's strong parallels between parenting and leadership. Because none of us have been a parent and none of us have been a leader until we're either. And so when you don't have a roadmap for something, you call in your default, in parenting world, it's default parenting map. It's like, how was I parented? Do I want to do that or do I not want to do that? It's kind of like,
100%.
So leadership's kind of the same. And so it's really important to reflect and become conscious of these patterns to know if they're actually going to serve you as a leader or a parent or not. What are your goals here? What are your default patterns? And, is it working for you? What do you want to A/B test? Mm-hmm. And then keep going.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. That's right.
Anyway, we could keep going here and where I know we're already like. But what have I not asked you, Jason? This, has been such a, just awesome conversation, very rich. But like, you want to share that I didn't actually ask you about or?
No, I love our conversation. I really think. To me, leadership doesn't have to be as difficult as people think it is. And I think there's a lot of fallacy around it. I think people think there's this, I got to have these, to your point earlier, as you're mentioning it, people think that the path has to be so clear in order for them to walk it. And I can honestly say that's not true. Every time I've tried to find the clear path, I've never found it.
Yeah.
If someone has, it may happen for some, that wasn't in my cards. So what I try to tell people, give people advice on, if I do give advice to people on stuff like this, is like, it's okay to dip your toes in different waters and some things will work, some things won't, but that's my point. Try it.
Yeah.
Don't stop. Don't be afraid to try something. And you might fail. Yeah. Some people might lose their job, in my role as HR, people sometimes don't understand how tough of a job we have because we are seeing people are like, oh, I can do HR, really? Then why do we still exist?
Yeah.
Honestly, I agree. If you could do it, then if I could work myself out of a job, great.
Go do it.
I have not yet.
Yeah.
I have not yet. But our jobs are changing. So one of the questions I get asked a lot nowadays, how is HR changing and significantly? I do believe HR people need to be, for a while there, not that I know you're a psychologist.
Yeah.
Not that we weren't focused on the feeling side of things. Yeah. I think that's super important. But now let's take that and bring the business acumen side in.
And how can we work within it?
And how do you operationalize it? Absolutely. So to me, I'm encouraging a lot of HR leaders to spend more time learning more about the business side. Now that you've got all these skills on emotional intelligence and EQ, and now take that to the business side, because when I go talk to a CFO, they're so skeptical when you walk in, right? You got to get through. Remember, you got to create that urgency. Got to get through that. So I spend a lot of time listening more. And what I mean by that is I kind of use Simon Sinek's little, for like, tell me more.
Yeah.
Tell me more. And again, what that builds? Trust.
Yep.
Once I start to get that trust, then influence occurs. Mm-hmm. And with Gen Z, I got to do it faster.
Yeah.
Because they're like, we get that. We've seen the YouTube. We've seen some podcasts. You're like, right. So now I got to speed things up. But my point is I try to say to folks, like, or I invite people to join me.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't you come to this meeting with me and sit and watch? Because there's no magic that happens in a board meeting. People think there's this like, oh my gosh, there must be, you guys must talk at this crazy high level. I'm like, actually, no, I asked them how their weekend was to start.
Yeah.
Just like you and I would in a meeting. And there's this, my very first time I met with a director, I remember saying this to my boss, who was a director. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I'm so nervous. I'm going to meet with a director. What a presentation. He's like, Jason, he puts his pants on the same way you do.
Totally.
It's going to be okay, man.
Yeah.
Just if you walk in with, you may stumble, but guess what? They don't know you're stumbling.
Yeah.
My wife was a professional ballet, tap, jazz, modern dancer. Yeah. She would tell me all the time. She's like, yeah, I get mad at myself, but they don't know I'm messing up on a step or two.
Yeah, totally.
So as long as you know that, and it's not a mistake, it's just, you got to work through it. Don't stop. You got to push through it. That's that dealing with ambiguity is what I try to teach people more, and learning the business side of things more, and then dealing with things might change on a fly. Don't get so offended by it if it changes. Now, I'll give this one last story about that. So I used to be in compensation in an auto company. I won't name their names at the time, but this VP that was the head of the comp and organization planning division, he would constantly, I'd give him a presentation to present to the CHRO. All my content I wanted him to move or do something with, he just changed it. And I'm like, gosh darn it, I wish he wouldn't change it, you know, because it was really good stuff, right? And then I realized, he just likes to put his mark on something, right?
Interesting.
So I just came up with this thing.
Is what you're figuring out.
He's right, exactly. So I said, you know, I'm going to try something. So I started misspelling a few words. Guess what? Started like crossing up the misspelled words, didn't change my content.
Interesting.
So I worked with it. Rather than getting frustrated by it, I just said, how can I work around this to still push what I'm hoping to get done? So funny story, fast forward 6 months later, my performance review, my boss goes, hey man, you really got to work on your spelling.
That's funny. Well, you unpacked his motivations. The behavior was crossing it out. His need was to be seen and heard, really, in some way. And you had like kind of met it in a different way. Well, this has been so fun. I feel like we could talk about 100 different topics, but I just appreciate you like taking time, especially on a Friday holiday, Jason. You know, this is
it's fine. No, you know what? This is important to me. And, you know, my longer term goal is to give back and maybe someday teach down the road. It's been a pleasure working in the industry. I don't know how many years I got left, but, you know, I'll be here as long as if they're willing to have me.
And then they'll be lucky to have
my retirement.
My
retirement plan.
Like, seems so great at your job, and you hold like the business and the people side like so well.
Thank you.
Like really
thank you very
that.
Much.
Yeah, and I forgot you're in Houston. I was supposed to go in the spring. I'll probably be coming.
Oh.
Yeah, in like either later summer. I'm going to have Austin.
Give me a shout out. I'd love to go do dinner or something. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's do it. Well, thank you so much for being here today, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you.